I'm Don McCrimmon. I'm the Vice President for Academic Affairs and Dean of the Faculty at Cazenovia College, and it is my extreme pleasure to welcome you all here this evening, including some special friends from Le Moyne College. In the fall of 2009, time flies, Cazenovia College was awarded a grant by the Dorothy and Marshall M. Riesman Foundation to initiate a speaker series. The focus of the series, which is to run at least 3 years, is to bring to the attention of the Cazenovia College community and the community at large notable persons whose outstanding work in many fields of endeavor can serve to inform and guide all of us. Today, tonight, we convene the second Riesman Lecture, this time with our great thanks to be here at the home of our beautiful neighbor institution, St. James Parish. Thank you very much, St. James. A selection committee composed of college trustees Dick Alberding and Marge Panay, Cazenovia College staff, including Joe Behan, Tim McLaughlin, and Wayne Westerfeldt, and me, has invited this evening's lecturer, Sister Helen Prejean, to speak to us, continuing the theme of advocacy. Advocacy, simply defined as the act or process of supporting a cause. Advocacy is an important context or concept in the context of a college education. It's an appropriate theme for a lecture at a college. We, women and men, who have had the privilege of gaining an education, have corresponding obligations to use our talents in the service and benefit of others. Sister Helen Prejean, best known for her landmark book, Dead Man Walking, is just such an advocate, with her almost 30 years in opposition to the death penalty. Now, at this point, I'd like to point out that copies of Sister Helen's books, Dead Man Walking and The Death of Innocence, including some special copies signed by both Sister Helen and Susan Sarandon, are available for purchase after the lecture in the St. James Hall. I'd also like to note an important event directly related to St. James or to Sister Helen's appearance this evening. Now, many of you may not know that there is a stage adaptation of the award-winning movie based on Sister Helen's book, Dead Man Walking. And Cazenovia College is proud to be producing the play later this fall as part of our celebration of Sister Prejean's visit and her life's work. The play is a moving portrait of Sister Prejean's experience the first time she met, counseled with, and advocated for death row inmates. Performances of our production at the college, directed by David Lowenstein, our artist in residence, will be November 12th, 13th, and 14th, and the 19th, and 20th, and 21st at the Catherine Cummings Theater. Please mark your calendars. You don't want to miss this. Let me introduce Sister Helen in a couple of ways. First, the way she describes herself. And then, a little more personally. Sister Helen Prejean has been instrumental in sparking national debate on the death penalty and helping to shape the Catholic Church's newly vigorous opposition to state executions, that includes a change in the catechism of the Catholic Church, something very fundamental that Sister Prejean has been entirely instrumental in providing. Sister Prejean travels around the world talking about her ministry, but I know from 26 and a half hours now that she also considers herself a Southern storyteller. She's a member of the Congregation of St. Joseph. She spent her first years with the sisters teaching religion to junior high school students, and then realizing that being on the side of poor people is an essential part of the gospel, she moved to the St. Thomas Housing Project in New Orleans, working at Hope House from 1994 to 1986. During this time, Sister Helen was asked to correspond with a death row inmate, Patrick Sonnier. He was at Angola Prison. She agreed, and she became his spiritual advisor. After witnessing his execution, she wrote a book about the experience. The result was Dead Man Walking, an eyewitness account. That book became a movie, a play, and is soon to be, I learned last night, an opera. Since 1984, Sister Helen has divided her time between educating citizens about the death penalty and counseling individual death row prisoners. She has accompanied 6 men to their deaths. In doing so, she began to suspect that some of those executed were not guilty. This realization inspired her second book, The Death of Innocence, an eyewitness account of wrongful execution. She's presently at work on another book, River of Fire, My Spiritual Journey. You were handed, when you came in this evening, some pieces of paper which asks if you, as individuals, would like to help end the death penalty. If you're interested in doing this and in working with Sister Helen to the realization of this goal, please fill out the form. There are pencils available at both entrances, and I'm sure you have pens and pencils of your own. And then there will be striped boxes placed throughout the hall and at the book signing, and you're welcome to place your forms there, and you'll be contacted by Sister Helen's organization. And Sister Helen will be signing books after the lecture this evening. Now, if you'll permit me, a bit more of a personal introduction. In 1996, the Catholic parish near Detroit that my family attended had grown so dramatically that an assistant priest was needed. Father George Lundy, a Jesuit priest who had recently assumed the post of provost at the University of Detroit Mercy, was named to be that assistant priest. In the course of time, he and I became good friends, and I learned of his own deep involvement with the spiritual counseling and advocacy work of Sister Helen at Angola Prison. Then our lives diverged. Several times, in fact. He ultimately became and continues to be a college chaplain at Southern University in Baton Rouge. And here I am at Cazenovia. In fact, soon after my arrival at Caz, I hosted George for a weekend at the college's gatehouse at the farm during a time when he was preparing to leave the presidency of Wheeling Jesuit University. Then, last Christmas, my family, my wife Rena, and our son and two daughters traveled to New Orleans to celebrate the holiday at Christmas. We invited George, who along the way in our family's life had married, or at least officiated, at the weddings of our two oldest children. We invited him to join us. One evening at dinner, I told George about the newly established Riesman Lectures. And I asked if he could arrange for an introduction to Sister Helen. In short order, I was put in touch with a nun with the formidable name of Sister Margaret. At least my early conversations with Sister Margaret suggested that here was a formidable gatekeeper for Sister Helen's schedule. I was told in a firm but quite friendly way that Sister Helen receives many more invitations than she's able to accept, and arrangements had to be made far, far in advance. Well, as you can see, thanks first to Father George, and then to Sister Margaret, and finally, Sister Helen's own acceptance, here she is. A woman that I have learned in just the last day is a warm, witty, wise, wonderful, and very earthy person who speaks with passion, authority, and real authenticity on a most difficult subject, an advocacy which is the work of her life. Please join me in welcoming Sister Helen Prejean.
Thank you. Thanks a lot. Is this working? Can y'all hear me? Well, after that introduction, I can't wait to hear what I'm going to say. Would be the same without you, Don. Welcome. Actually, we're going to go on a hard journey tonight. The death penalty is a tough one. You know, when William Faulkner, the Southern writer, got the Nobel Prize for Literature, he said the only thing worth writing about is the human heart in conflict with itself. And I'm going to tell you my story and how it unfolded. Didn't begin, for me, even understanding about social justice. That was all a gradual realization in my life. And what I've discovered over these years of crisscrossing this country and talking to audiences across the country, just like you, in universities and churches and synagogues and civic groups, is it's not that the American people have reflected deeply on the death penalty and decided that they're in favor of it. So many people just simply haven't had an occasion to go deeply into the reflection of what the death penalty really means. And of course, we're outraged over crimes done to innocent people where they are ripped out of life in the most horrendous ways that you can imagine. And we feel the outrage of that, and it's just such a natural instinct to say, well, whoever did that deserves to get the death penalty. That's what the death penalty is for. So how do you get a nation, how do you get a people to engage in discourse, to go deeper? And you know, I love being here because I found out about Garrett Smith, and I found out that the heart of the first abolitionist movement was right in these parts here about slavery. And it was right here in this section of the country that first consciousness began and then you awaken the rest of the country. It's the way any social movement happens. Some people come awake, and then we awaken the others. And then as a people, then we come to see, no, it's not good to have some human beings as property of other human beings. But controversies were hot and heavy, and economics was involved. People's property was involved because of agriculture and needing the slaves to do, I mean, it's all the issues. Once we look back on them, we go, oh, well, of course you shouldn't have human beings as property. There will be a day when we're going to look back and say, oh, my goodness, do you mean in the United States of America into the 21st century that we actually took some human beings and warehoused them and then took them out and killed them in this country, that we did that, that we had what you call the death penalty? That even when most nations in the world have done away with the death penalty, we are one of the few that hold on to it in the company of Iraq, in the company of Iran, in the company of China. Most countries of the world have done away with the death penalty, but not us. Now, how is that possible? And I want to say this about getting the discourse going, is that when Dead Man Walking came out in the hardback in 93, this paperback in 94, the thing about a book is it's like a child. It has legs. It goes where it wants to go, this book. You send it out there. Well, the book wanted to go into the lap of Susan Sarandon. There may be others in the room who wish to imitate the book. But Susan was doing The Client, John Grisham's, in Memphis. She was filming The Client, and a friend gave her the book. And she started reading it on the set. When you're doing a film, you spend a lot of time in that little trailer, waiting to go on the set, all that kind of stuff. She started reading it. She called me up. And the nuns, of course, had told me after the book came out, Helen, don't let Hollywood touch this book, because you know what they're going to do. You know, nuns don't do well in those Hollywood films. So they don't know what to do with nuns. And they're going to try to spice it up and have you eloping with that death row inmate. Don't let them do a movie this book. Well, and then I get a phone call, and it's from Susan Sarandon. She said, I'm reading your book now. I have to come to New Orleans for a couple of days of filming, and I'd like to meet you, and I'd like to talk about doing a film. Well, right away I go. I don't know what the lady looks like. I know that she was really good on human rights. I'd learned that from Amnesty International. So I rent Thelma Louise, see what she looks like, you know. So when she comes in the restaurant, I don't want to be the only one in the restaurant. You know, I don't know the lady. So rent Thelma Louise and mix her up with Gina Davis through the whole movie. So when she comes in the restaurant, I went, oh, thank you, Jesus, she's Louise. I was so relieved that she wasn't that ditzy one, you know, doing all the crazy stuff with little Brad Pitt. And I like, oh. And there she was. And the two of us sat at a table, and Susan Sarandon is the one that had the passion to make this film happen. It took her 9 months to get Tim Robbins to read the book because he was doing other projects. And one night, 9 months into it, he hadn't read the book, and he hadn't read the book, and they're walking along the streets of New York, and she takes him by the arm, and she said, and she breaks into tears and says, Tim, if we're not going to do a film of that book, then we need to turn it over to someone who will. So probably for domestic tranquility, he says, I'll read the nun's book. I'll read the book. And then that was just the first hurdle. Then he writes a screenplay, and every Hollywood studio turned it down. They never dreamed. They said, Tim, it's kind of a heavy movie. Dead Man Walking, that gives people a lift. The title. And then you got a nun in it. There's no romantic element. I mean, you know, let us, and they want to do their little thing, you know. And he said, no, it's not about spicing it up between the nun and the death row inmate. It's a journey of redemption. And when Dead Man Walking came out across this country, and he got 4 nominations, and Susan, as you know, got the Academy Award, the book and the film was given over to the world, because Susan got the Academy Award. And 4 times, there were 1.3 billion people look at these Academy Awards. And they heard about Dead Man Walking. And it was the Feast of the Annunciation, those of you who are Catholics. And you talk about an annunciation. Well, this was quite an annunciation. And then that is what took the book and for 8 months put it on the New York Times bestseller list. The movie is not like any other movie. The movie does just what Faulkner said to do, because the movie takes you over to both sides of this issue. The movie takes you to a terrible crime. The movie takes you over to the suffering victims on one side and then the perpetrator on the other, who, as he moves toward execution, we discover he has a mother. He has brothers. And another family now is going to go through the death. We have David Kaczynski in here. His brother is a Unabomber, was accused of the Unabomber. And he leads New Yorkers to abolish the death penalty. And if you want to meet some principled, wonderful people, people like David, who have been thrown in this fire, and David can tell you his story, he's worth having come up here to speak as well. And he has murder victims' families with him, all people who have had their loved ones killed. And know this, that in the witnessing in this country that is helping us to come to a new consciousness, murder victims' families are playing a very big role. Because when New Jersey 2 years ago did away with the death penalty, 62 murder victims' families appeared before the New Jersey legislature and said, "Don't kill for us." But let's go there. Let's go into the journey. And this is the way I tell you in Dead Man Walking. As I become conscious of it, you become conscious. I wrote it in the present tense. And in the beginning, as I said, my consciousness was very, very limited. I grew up very privileged, very cushioned, very protected, excellent private school, taught by Sisters of St. Joseph, became a nun early on, and was continued to be kind of protected because I taught in a suburban school in New Orleans, in which, in the inner city, was 10 major housing projects of struggling African-American people, and I didn't know any of them. And part of the privilege of growing up, and the only way I did know African-American people in days of deep segregation, was as our servants in my father and mother's house. I don't know people. I don't know what they're going through. And you read about things. And then generally it tends to be, well, slavery's long over. Come on now. Let's get on with it. Anybody can get a job who wants to. We have education today. We got public schools. Come on. Come on. And all of it is about waking up. There's a story told about the Buddha that people said to him, "Who are you? Are you a prophet?" He goes, "No, I'm not a prophet." They said, well, who are you? And he says, "I am one who is awake. All spiritual traditions help us to become awake. And the deepest part of all spiritual traditions help us to know that we are one and compassionate." What leads us into trouble as a society is when we turn that switch and said, "No, but not them. They're extremists, or they're terrorists, or they're death row inmates. They're not human the way we are, and in order for us to live, we must kill them. In order to be safe, we must have their deaths." And I have witnessed at trials that prosecutors with the victim's family sitting there and saying, "Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, look at that family. They have lost their daughter. They will never see their grandchildren. And I want to ask you to straighten your spines and to bite the bullet and to give justice for that family, because their child is dead forever. And this person is alive. And this person knowingly killed that innocent person. And for justice to be done, a death deserves a death. Give them that justice." First, when I awoke, it was to the poor. Jesus was on the side of the poor. I'm saying that to you in a simple sentence. There was a lot, and I was a Catholic nun, but I wasn't with poor people. I didn't know. There was no bridge to them. I felt bad for them. I'd pray for people, but I didn't know why the poor are poor. And you know, for a long time, in a lot of Christian churches, it was, well, if poor people are poor, that's the will of God for them. They suffer, but one day they're going to have a great reward in heaven. Is it God's will that people's children die before they're 5 years old? Is it God's will that people don't have education and they don't have jobs and they don't have housing? Is that God's will that poor people be poor? If people are poor in our society, it's because of decisions and policies we have decided and we live out of. I'm going to learn that. And the awakening came at a talk. The sister was talking to us. And I had been resistant. The sisters were all talking about doing social justice. And I went, look, we are nuns. We are not social workers. I don't get it about all this social justice. As long as we have charity. And even Jesus had said, the poor you'll always have with you. That is the world. That is just the way it is. It ain't fair, but that's the way it is. And I didn't get it that we needed to be an advocate, as Donna said. An advocate? What do you mean, an advocate? Charity. What we need in the world is charity. They even had a song at a time. What the world needs now is love, sweet love. I mean, you know, just have love. Just have charity. What do you mean, justice? And this nun gave a talk. And my whole spiritual world, and I tell you about it in Dead Man Walking. It's the first part of my story was awakening. That to be a person of faith in the following of Jesus meant that I was going to be on the side of poor people, which means I had to meet them. Our mother house was in the suburbs, and the first of 10 major housing projects was literally just half, 1/16th of a mile away from us. But geographically, it could have been in India, because I never went there. We do not go into the sections where poor people are in our country because we are afraid of those sections. And I was one that just fit right into that. And when I awakened, I realized I don't even know any poor people, even in my own city. Kind of like the little girl at the time, I wrote an essay called The Poor Family. Once it was a very poor family. The mother was poor, the father was poor, the children were poor. Everyone was poor. The butler was poor. The chauffeur was poor. The whole family was poor. So when you don't know real people, that's the kind of essay I could have written. But when I woke up, then I moved into the St. Thomas Housing Projects where four other sisters lived. And that's the way Dead Man Walking opens, is that I'm in the projects there with the people and just learning from the people. I'm learning it now from the point of view of what it means to be poor and black with the police. I didn't know the police had beaten people up. I never would have been scared of a policeman if my car had broken down at 2 o'clock in the morning on the highway and a state trooper would pull up. I'd be glad. I know I'm going to get some help. It was a different point of view. And that's not to say all policemen do this, but there was enough. When I did research for Dead Man Walking, I found out there were more complaints to the Justice Department of police brutality in New Orleans than any other city. But I'm living out in the suburbs in New Orleans. I don't know anything about that. I don't know people are being treated unjustly. And then the school. I had such an excellent school. I taught in parochial schools. And here at Hope House, we had a dropout center for people who had dropped out of high school and could come get their GEDs, and I was shocked. I didn't know this. And here are kids coming in. Here's this kid coming in. Well, how far did you get in school? Well, I was a junior. I said, oh, you only had one more year to go. Okay, look, let's see what your reading level is. Let's see what your math level is. And a kid couldn't read a third grade reader. He's a junior in high school. He can't read a third grade reader. And I think of St. Joseph Academy. I knew how to do public speaking by the time I was a junior. I knew how to write. So one day when I go to write a book, I know how to write. I know how to read critically. What's going to happen to a kid who's going to come out of high school, even if he finishes and he can't read? He doesn't have a chance in this society. Why did I receive so much? And being there with people who were struggling in every way, one of the things it did for me was it put me in touch. That not that I was that virtuous, but that I had been so protected. And protection and being cushioned is not virtue. It just means you've never been exposed to the test. And so I better be in there giving. And it's while I was there that one day, coming out of the Adult Learning Center, a friend who worked in the Louisiana Prison Coalition office sees me coming down St. Andrew Street. It was so casual. He had a little clipboard. Everybody was meeting that day. He's asking them to be part of this project. Boom, bumps into me like two little ants. He says, hey, sister, you want to be a pen pal, somebody on death row? I said, yeah, sure, I could do that. You know, he signed me up here on the thing, and he gave me the name of this man. I thought, you know, I can write some nice letters. I was an English major. I could write some nice letters to the person. It was 1982. We hadn't executed anybody in Louisiana in over 25 years. There'd been an informal hiatus on the death penalty across the country. I never dreamed they were going to kill him, much less that I would be there. And I want to say the spiritual path we take, that God gives us a little pen light, not a great big old searchlight. Here's what's going to wait for you at the end of this road. But a little pen light. I knew this. If somebody's sitting on death row, I didn't know a lot about the death penalty issue. There's the other social justice issues. I didn't know a lot. But I knew this. Somebody's sitting on death row in Louisiana, he's poor. Like the word on the streets was, capital punishment means them without the capital get the punishment. Only poor people go to death row. You never have people who have a whole lot of money and wealth who can access the best lawyers who are going to make every constitutional protection work for them. And we don't begrudge them that. It's just that isn't it funny when you look at the over 3,000 people sitting on death row today? You look at the 1,200 people who have been executed in this country, every one of them, virtually, was a poor person. Well, I'm going to learn. I wrote the man a letter. And here was where the problem started, because he wrote back. And when you have an encounter between two human beings, it doesn't matter who the two people are, that communication, and then it all... As I learned from the letters, he never asked me for anything. He never asked me to send him money for cigarettes. He never asked me to come see him. He was just glad somebody had found him. He had been so alone. His mother couldn't come because mentally she wasn't that stable. She had visited one time, walked into death row, sees death row written there above the gate, and she almost had a nervous breakdown. He said, Mama, don't come. Don't come, Mom. It's too hard on you. You just pray for me, Mama, and just write. And his letters are just talking about his life in a 6 foot by 8.5 foot cell, confined 23 out of 24 hours a day. And he's not like playing the violin on it, oh, woe is me, what a tough life I have. I figured he's guilty, whatever it was, don't know the crime yet. But then I was meditating on the scriptures one day, and there it was, Matthew 25. I mean, you know, this is a classic. I was hungry, you gave me to eat. I was a stranger, you took me in. Then I was in prison and he came to me. If there's going to be a visit, he's sure not going to commute to see me. So I write him a little note and I just say, I'll come see you sometime. I wasn't changing my ministry. I wasn't changing anything in my life. I just said, I'll come see you. And in the return mail, so excited because it means he gets a visitor. And you see, you have these different categories of visitors. Like, are you a girlfriend? Are you relative? Are you just friend? And he had written, I'm a Catholic, and you're a nun. Will you be my spiritual advisor? Fill it in, spiritual advisor. Send it in. And little do I know that 2 years later, he is going to be killed in the electric chair at midnight, and at 5:45 in the evening, everyone has to leave the death house except the spiritual advisor, who's going to be me. And I'm going to be with him when they kill him. And I'm going to tell him to look at my face, and it's going to change my life forever. We don't know when we go down the path. We go according to the lights we have and according to what it is that we know we have to do. You know, Theodore Rethke, great poem, I wake to sleep and take my waking slow. I learn by going where I have to go. And so then I visited him. And I take you through all these steps in the book. And I'm going to go over this kind of quickly because there are a lot of parts I want to get to on this journey tonight. I'm giving you the hors d'oeuvres, though. The story's in the book. And a book is a good thing. I just want to say this about reading. Because when you read, you are in a private, cloistered place. And you are alone. And you don't have to debate with anybody. And you can use your own imagination, and you can go there. And plus, it's going to give you information. And so I didn't know a book had such power. I've learned that a book can take you there. And So would I would go to visit him. And I was scared out of my cotton picking mind. You got to know New Orleans is a real, 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 real Catholic city, and nuns get a whole lot of respect just by walking out the door. And here I am in this prison. They have this big green sign. If I'm stepping onto prison property, you subject yourself to this body search, dog sniffing, body cavities. I stopped reading because my heart, and I was going, I am out of my element. I am out of my depth. I can't play the nun card here. You can do it with policemen sometime, but you sure can't do it in Louisiana State Penitentiary. So scary. And then they bring me, clang, clang, these gates clanging behind me. Woman on the tier. In the opera, we do have the opera. It premiered in San Francisco in 2000, and now it's going all over the country. There's a song that sings, woman on the tier. And all these prisoners going, woman on the tier, woman, 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 woman on the tier. Like, you know, Great Attraction. And the guards brought him in. And they had him locked in a little booth, as big as a telephone booth. I'm on the other side of a heavy mesh screen. And I have to confess that as I waited in a room, they had locked me in a room before they brought him in. I was very nervous about him. Because I was thinking, you know, anybody can write a nice letter, you know. I've never been with a murderer for 2 hours. Is he going to look different? Is he going to be? Can you have the normal conversation with somebody who murdered somebody? Will his eyes look different? Will his jaw, will he? You know, you see those mug shots of those murderers, and they look so mean, and what's he really like? And the guards brought him in, and I had to look through this heavy mesh screen. He was locked on the other side, and I was shocked. I could not believe how human his face was, and he was smiling. He said, sister, you drove all that way to come see me. Thank you for coming. I could not believe the humanness of his face. And so we began. So in 2 hours, the visit was over. I didn't have to worry about what I was going to say. I was so glad to have a presence. And then I'm driving home. I did learn one thing in the course of the visit, that he said his brother was serving 2 life sentences. And I thought, how do you have a murder and one brother gets death and one brother gets life? I didn't know how the thing worked. And the Sonia case is more complex than this, but did you know that when you do have 2 defendants in a murder and there are no other witnesses, if one gets on the stand, points to the other one in the courtroom and say, yeah, he did it, they get a reduced sentence for saying that? So how do we know even from square one we get into truth? And don't you think if we're taking such an absolute step to end a person's life, we better have some kind of relatively, if you can use the term, absolute way of getting to the truth about who did what. And we are now in this country with 139 wrongfully convicted people who have come off of death row, saved by college volunteers and innocence projects who go in and dig up the evidence of what was supposed to be done at trial and was not, and that's directly linked to poor people and not getting the defense. Or even sometime where people in the States try to do it right. It's just so many ways you can get it wrong. Do you ever hear 2 people who are divorcing each other and you hear her side and you hear his side, how complex that is? Who's wrong? Who you really blame for this, if anybody? Well, imagine where you're supposed to put evidence together, you're supposed to put eyewitnesses together, and then you're supposed to convince the jury not only that the person's guilty, not just simply that you'll let them be in life without parole and protect society, but that you got to kill them. That the nature of this crime is such that we have to ask their death, including that we need to ask it for the victim's family. So I begin when I make the drive to go visit both brothers, Patrick and Eddie. And then I was over in the prison coalition office. Several months had gone by, and I didn't want to be naive. I know somebody's been murdered, maybe more than one person, I don't know. But I said, could I see some background information on the Sonia case? And they pulled out all these manila files that looked so bland on the outside. And inside, there's a volcano inside us. And I opened up the one on the top of the heap and looked into the faces of two beautiful teenage kids. Their family had sent their prom picture in this little Louisiana town, New Iberia, where Cajun people live. Their prom picture of David LeBlanc and Loretta Bourque. David, 17 years old, the only son in this family. When he was killed, the family name died with David. And Loretta Bourque, who's 18 years old. And there they are smiling and looking beautiful, a happy night in their life. And then there is the headline, teenagers found murdered. And then I read the details of the story. Found out these two brothers that I'm visiting and whose spiritual advisor I now am, killed these two kids in cold blood on a November night. We're coming to the anniversary of their death, November 4th. The parents are dreading the date because, again, they relive. In the morning, their child was alive. In the evening, they went to a football game, and they were never seen alive again. And they were found near a sugarcane field, and they had both been shot, execution style, on the back of the head. They never had a chance. And now I'm reading the story, and I know I am the spiritual advisor to the two people who killed these two innocent teenage kids. How can you not be outraged when we hear about the death of innocent people, like young people, their whole lives budding, just beginning, and they have been ripped out of life in this senseless act of violence? I'm horrified by it. Then I'm doubly horrified because I'm going, I'm spiritual advisor to the people who did this. And I remember thinking, this is every parent's worst nightmare. And everybody was Catholic in this. The Bourque family who lost their daughter, the LeBlancs who lost their son David, me the nun, the Sauniers, everybody Catholic. And I remember thinking, I ought to go see those parents. What are they going through? Maybe I could be of help to them in some small way. And then I was scared. I went, they're not going to want to see me. They're not going to want to see the one who's the spiritual advisor to the two people who kill their innocent children. And I stayed away. I stayed away. It was a terrible mistake. And Tim brings out this tension in the film. It's in the book, of course, because it's in the story. It's the truth of what happened. But I stayed away from them. I didn't do anything. I didn't call them. I didn't write them. And I met them at the worst possible time you could meet a victim's family. It couldn't have been more polarized. It was the pardon board hearing, a public meeting where both sides come. The pardon board is going to be presented with reasons for clemency not to kill Patrick Sonnier. And I'm there with one lawyer and one psychiatrist, and everybody else filling the room is the victim's family and their relatives and their friends, saying to the pardon board, give us our justice. And that was when I met the Bourque family who'd lost their daughter and the LeBlancs who lost their son. And we were walking outside of the building while they were voting. And we were on this in this narrow space. I think if I could have escaped then, I would have. And here come both of the couples toward me on the sidewalk in this kind of enclosed area. And I ran right into them. And the Bourques were furious at me, and I deserved their anger. They dealt with it in a very dignified way, and by not screaming at me. They just averted their gaze and silently walked past me without saying a word, and right behind them was the other family, the LeBlanc family, who had lost their son, and I expected the same thing. You ever noticed how human beings have a way of popping out of the box? And here's Lloyd LeBlanc and his wife, Eula, and they walk right up to me. And he says to me, Sister Helen, I'm Lloyd LeBlanc. This is my wife, Eula. It's our son, David, who was killed, sister. Sister, all this time, you've been visiting with those two brothers, and you didn't want to come see us. You can't believe the pressure we're under with the death penalty. I didn't know victims' families wanted any kind of pressure. I didn't know what he meant. How could I have been of help to him? What did he mean? Pressure. He said, sister, you need to come and walk with us. I pray in this little chapel. You need to come. And he was inviting me. He could have been furious at me, just as the Bourques had, and just rejected me, which I would have deserved because I hadn't reached out to him. But I made my way over to him. Pressure on him. What did pressure on him mean? He said, sister, everybody's saying to me, Lloyd, you got to be for the death penalty. Because the murder had been so horrendous. And people were saying, Lloyd, if you're not for the death penalty, it's going to look like you didn't love David. Didn't you love your boy? Don't you see what's happening to you and your family? And they're offering you the ultimate penalty, and you're going to ask for something less? It's going to look like you didn't love David. That's what he meant by pressure. He's telling me this. And he explained to me, the first person I ever met that explained to me what it means to forgive. Because he said, you know, people think forgiveness is weak. People think forgiveness means you condone what they did. Oh, you kill my son, forgive and forget, it's okay. Like you condone the murder. With all the suffering they were going through, Eula almost lost her mind. She cried for 3 years. They had to move David's grave from a family plot in another little town, just a few yards away from the house in a nearby cemetery, so Eula could visit her son's grave every day of her life. And he said, so everybody was saying to me, Lloyd, you got to be for the death penalty. And I tried to go there. I did. I tried. I went, right, they're right. Look at our suffering. I want to see him dead. I wish I could pull the switch. And he said, but I didn't like the way it made me feel inside. Because all my life I've been a kind person. I love to do things for people. It's just who I am. It's like part of me, who I am. And he said, and then when I think of that and that hatred and that bitterness would get into me. And then he said, no. They killed our son, but I'm not going to let them kill me too. And I'm going to do what Jesus said. He's the hero of Dead Man Walking. I end the book with him. I end the book. I know the last line of the book, and it's dedicated to him. Forgiveness was never going to be easy. Each day it must be prayed for and struggled for and won, because forgiveness is a path, not one act, not done once and for all. It's a stance. It's a way of being. He was the first to teach me that what it means is that you're not going to let the love in you be overcome by the hatred, that you're going to stand in the love and the integrity of your being and not become someone else because of what has happened to you. Through him, I began to go to parents of murdered children meeting. I began to go to the victims' meetings because I had completely not done that before. And I got my next big shock. And the shock was that as people are sitting at this meeting and sharing their sorrow and their loss, how many of them said, everybody stays away from us. Nobody knows what to do with our pain. Even the people in my church. One woman said, I was trying to talk to my best friend about our daughter's death. It's been 2 years. And I began to cry. And she said, oh, really, Susan, shouldn't you be past that by now? You should get help. But if anybody needs community, it is victims, families that need us by their side. When their marriages break apart, 70% of people who lose their children, the marriages break apart. They have different ways of grieving. One wants to keep the child's clothes like a shrine and not touch them. The other saying, honey, we have to move on. Let's give the clothes to Goodwill. We have other children. Whatever fault lines are in the marriage, it breaks it apart. And they need community by their side. When they break apart, come together. When they lose their jobs because they can't focus. We need to embrace both. Compassion, not to leave them alone. I was just in Boulder, Colorado. This woman's son had just graduated from college. He was with his fiance, and they were both blown away in this terrible, terrible murder. And in there with her was somebody who belonged to Parents of Murdered Children meeting. And he said, "Sister, you want to see a room emptied? Watch me walk into it. Because I lost my child," and people just stay away from the pain. That's an execution image up there. Now we have Jesus in a resurrected or transcendent of death, but that is an execution. And the young Jesus going to Jerusalem would have seen what Rome did, like don't mess with Rome, of seeing 1,000 people hung on those poles, on that wood, because that was the way they punished criminals. And there are 2 arms on that cross. And I want to say that all that is deepest within us, in whatever our spiritual tradition might be, always is the invitation, deepest of all, to compassion and reconciliation. And what if one of the arms, our arms, can stretch out to the murder victims' families? And what if one of our arms then can also stretch out to the people in prison and the perpetrators, who many of us in society say that we are to despise? You have to turn that switch. They deserve what they get. That's what punishment is for. I end up, through Lloyd LeBlanc and his graciousness, that I come and begin to walk with the murder victims' families. And then I'm with the man, Patrick Saunier, when they kill him. When they kill him in the coldest, most calculated protocol of death you can imagine. When we were doing the film, and Susan, we were doing the filming in the death house where you're counting down the days, 3 days to live, 2 days to live, 1 day to live, then you're on the day of the execution, and you begin to count the hours. And Susan kept saying, "This is so surreal." And there is an aspect about it that's so difficult to get your mind around, because you see, he's alive. And you're talking like you've talked for 2 years. And he's drinking coffee and you're visiting. And you're in this place and the tiles are all polished and the coffee pot's percolating. And they're typing the pages for witnesses to sign, and people are coming in and things are getting busy. And the light's dim because that means the electrician is in and he's checking the chair to make sure that the generator is hooked up and there's going to be enough electricity in this to kill this person tonight. They never use the words. In fact, the word execution is a euphemism. You execute a forward pass at a game, or you execute a business plan. Execution means you're killing a human being. You know when the moment of truth comes after an execution? It's either 10 southern states that I belong to, Louisiana. We are the executioners. We do over 80% of all the execution. You were never terribly serious about the death penalty when you had it for 9 years in New York before your Supreme Court overturned your statute because it was unconstitutional. But you know where they have to tell the truth? The only time in the whole process where they name it for what it is on the death certificate. After they kill a person and you have to fill in cause of death. So what you gonna say, failure to breathe? Cause of death. What is the cause of death? They have to write, homicide. It's the killing of a human being by another human being. Now, often they'll put legal, or they'll say homicide by legal execution or legal lethal injection. They make it legal. And I am in this unreal world now with this man, having made my way over to the murder victim's family, and now I'm with him. And now I'm with his mother. And now I'm with his family, who are going through the death of their child. Mrs. Saunier, Patrick, and Eddie's mother couldn't go in the grocery store in St. Martinville because she could overhear people saying when she came into the store, for her ears, loud enough for her to hear, "There she is, that white trash woman. Her sons killed the Bourke and the LeBlanc children. I can't wait until he's executed. I wish we could have gotten them both." They're cutting up dead animals and throwing them on the front porch. How do you have hatred, legalize hatred for the person, the one who did the crime, but say, now don't hate his mama Don't hate his family. Now be nice to them. You can't stop hatred in a village or in a town, because it extends to the mother. It extends to the brothers and sisters. The kids are being made fun of at school. Patrick's little girl, Star, had to change schools. He had an aunt who said, "Honey, would you like to take ballet lessons?" She said, "No, I want to take karate." Because she was so threatened. "Your daddy's a murderer. Your daddy's a murderer. They're going to fry him." You don't think the children are going to have any more sensitivity than their parents have. Like the child, don't be mean to a child. And so it is. And so I was with him. So I was waiting with him in this death house. So it was so unbelievable to me. The third day, the second, and the first, and finally you come to the day of his death. Right after midnight, April 5th, 1984. And I couldn't believe it was all happening. I had started out on this journey thing. I was writing to this person. He wrote back. Now I'm visiting him. And now they were revving up executions in Louisiana again. And now they have executed two people, killed two people ahead of Patrick, and he's going to be the third. And I'm with him. I'm with him in this. The guards. I meet the guards. You ever think, when the state is going to terminate a human life, we're going to have the persons to do it for us? It's not going to be us. They're going to be people. They work in prisons. Have you heard any of the stories coming out of Texas? Have you heard about Warden Willette, who was present at 100 executions and who just spilled it all out when he did his interview on National Public Radio about what it did to him? Have you heard the stories about one of the guards who just strapped people down in that chair, Texas, who has killed over 450 human beings? And his job was just to strap a person down, then leave the room. They practice, you know, they have to practice for the moment, because they got to prepare themselves if the person fights them all the way and say, "Don't kill me, don't kill me," as happened with Lewis Williams in Ohio. He had been calm the day before. He was reading his Bible. He had seen his lawyers until the guards went to get him for his execution. And he grabbed the bars of his cell. His hands were like welded to the bars, and he began to scream, "Oh God, save me, God. You are my witness. You know I'm innocent." And he's looking into the eyes of the guards, saying, "Don't kill me. Don't kill me." So the guards have to pry his hands loose, and he struggles all the way. They half carry, half drag him onto the gurney, throw their bodies over him on the gurney, and begin strapping him down. And there was a telling moment. Whoever the journalist was who wrote that story, there was a one telling moment in there where one of the guards, in the midst of all this, patted him on the shoulder reassuringly, like everything is going to be okay. When we're outraged over crime, and when inside ourselves we say, "Well, whoever did this, they deserve the death penalty. Could I do it? Could I do it? Can I take personal responsibility for saying I believe in the death penalty, and yes, I will do it?" Or is there a part of us that steps back and goes, "Well, I don't know if I could, but somebody needs to"? Then I want to say to you, there's a part of your soul that has not fully said yes to the death penalty. That we're ambivalent about it? Yeah. That we're outraged over the death of innocent people? I want to say it's ethical to feel outraged over the death of innocent life. We should feel outraged. But notice in ourselves which deaths we feel outraged over and which ones don't even cause a little blip. It's like we expect it. Well, these are these kids, these gang members killing each other. We don't feel the same outrage. It's usually around people who are like us, because we identify. When it's somebody like us, we feel. But what do we do as a society? Well, what we're doing as a society is that we are killing human beings, and we kill them for their crime. In fact, it's such a point that we're saying, even though the states all have life without parole now, but in some cases you have to kill the person. It's the only way we can be safe. Is it? You ever think of the jurors? 12 ordinary folks like us who were asked, you know that story of Solomon in the Bible, of the two women who both claimed it was their baby, said, give me a sword, we'll cut the baby in two, and that way the real mom came and said, no, don't kill the baby. That wisdom story of Solomon. Well, look at what jurors face. Here's an awful, unspeakable crime. And you know that. We get the facts. Okay, the person's guilty. But then you come to the second trial. You look at the person's life. It's never just crime, but it's culpability. Well, who did that crime? Let's look at that person's life. Is the only thing we can do morally to give them death? Well, what's their story? And I'm going to tell you one from Louisiana, because Denny LaBeouf is a good friend of mine who's a defense attorney who took John Brooks's case when he got a second sentencing hearing in Louisiana, because the court had overturned the first one. Here was a man who went with an automatic gun and shot and killed 6 people and was reloading to kill more people when they overcame him. So the first juror, hands down, death sentence, look at this, 6 people. What's worse than this? Until Denny got his case. And they had a new jury. And it was all about, will he get death or will he get life? And Denny goes and puts her hand on John Brooks' shoulder. She said, now let me tell you about the story of my client and what happened to him before he went in that day with that rifle and killed innocent people. The first beating he got was by his 13-year-old mother when she was pregnant for him and was beating on her stomach because she thought she had a bad case of worms. And that was the beginning of beatings in John Brooks's life. So he came into the world with his brain already, and then in a series of relationships in his mother's life of people who beat him, and that violence pumped into him. One day he went in with that gun and he killed innocent people, and then he said to the jury, the state of Louisiana never did one thing to help John Brooks. Is our only option now to kill him. And they came back with a unanimous decision not to give the death penalty, but for him to be in prison for the rest of his life. One interesting thing that happened around this is when that jury went out, the assistant district attorney, who they were pressing for the death penalty. You get into a winning thing here. Winning means you get the death sentence. If you don't get a death sentence, it means you lost. And when the jury was out for so long, she knew what that meant. It meant they were moving toward a life sentence. She knew that. And she put her head down on the table there and began to weep and began to say, it's not going to happen for me. In my second book, The Death of Innocence, I take you through 2 cases where people are killed, where they are executed. And I want, when you read the story, I believe they're innocent. Well, I'll let you read it for yourself. And know that by the time you come to their execution, all the facts that the jury never heard, where the bar is just reasonable doubt that they would not be convicted of doing this crime. And all the things that can happen. And one of the things I came to in the end of this book was the death penalty isn't good for anybody. Prosecutors most of the time do the right thing. They know their mission is to get justice for the community and to protect the community. But when they're under pressure, when there's a high-profile murder, when the media is all on it and the pressure's on them, get somebody. And that's when human beings make mistakes. That's when human beings feel, if I don't go for the death penalty, I'll not be reelected to this job. I have to go for death, and there's pressure on them. And one of the statements I make, and I lay this before you, that the death penalty taints everybody it touches. And I take on in the second book the Supreme Court of the United States. The decisions they have made under the Rehnquist Court to take constitutional protections and pare them down and pare them down and pare them down. You're supposed to have an attorney who's going to fight for you. But in the Strickland decision of the Supreme Court, they made the requirement so tight and so hard that you could have a drunk attorney, you could have an attorney on drugs, and they didn't find him ineffective. For 18 years, the Supreme Court never found lawyers ineffective, no matter how terrible they were doing for their client. Race, McCleskey decision. David Baldus did a study that showed clearly in the pattern of application of the death penalty, clearly, overwhelmingly, that it's when white people are killed that the death penalty is sought. Seldom, if ever, will you find a white person ever executed for killing a person of color. 50% of all the people in this country are people of color. But yet, when you look on death row, when you look in the application, 8 out of every 10 death sentences is because a white person had been killed. And it was clear to them, there's race. And the Supreme Court in the McCleskey decision said it is clear that race plays a part in the application of the death penalty, but it would be too disruptive of the criminal justice system to remedy it. Our Supreme Court doesn't live in a goldfish bowl apart from us, and the attitudes of our society are in them too. The first abolition movement began here, and in this very spot, in these very towns, in this, to abolish slavery. And we helped here people who awoke, people who became advocates, people who worked for change. And that's what we're going to do with the death penalty too. And let me give you the hope. Since 2001, with all the news coming in of the innocent people, it really shook our confidence in the criminal justice system. And there's been a rapid decrease in the number of death sentences given. The 10 southern states that practice slavery are still our main executioners, my state, Louisiana, among them, and Texas, and Florida, and Alabama, and Georgia, and you can name them. But death penalties aren't being given as much, even in Texas now. Houston, Harris County, that was responsible for 1/4 of all the people on death row in Texas, last 2 years, no death sentence. What's going on? We are shutting down the death penalty in practice in this country. Please God, the day will come when we also will understand why it is that morally we should not ever entrust government to kill human beings, that we don't need to kill to be safe. One last little thing I'd like to share with you is that you did kind of overplay that a little bit, Don, when you said single-handedly changed the Catholic teaching. Now, I've got to make some things clear, okay? No change ever happened single-handedly on anything. It's like bubbles in the pot. When a pot is boiling, the bubbles come up all over. And there was a change in consciousness that has happened in the world about human rights. Over the last 40 years, the most dramatic change has happened about the death penalty and countries doing away with the death penalty. We're in the last of the Mohicans on this. Eventually, we too are going to join them. We're on our way as of now. But the Catholic Church had, like most Christian churches, started out with a traditional teaching of that in order to protect society from really dangerous people, when you don't have prisons, it's okay for the state to execute people to keep society safe. It was always about defending society. It was never about an eye for an eye. They killed, so we killed them. And that's what God wants us to do, as though we could ever be the ministers of God and be God's divine agents for God's wrath. Is that? Who thinks that? Well, you'll see that Justice Scalia kind of thinks that, and he's in the second part of Death of Innocence. He said it at a conference in Chicago. He translated. He did exegesis of Romans 13 and said, clearly, wrath of the sword, God has appointed us in the United States as to be the divine ministers of God's wrath. I thought in a democracy we didn't get the divine authority directly to the government, but we got it from the people. So you have the Catholic Church too. State has a right to execute, to defend society, but only for grave or grievous crimes. Where the change came in that catechism I was part of it. The second story in that book is Joseph Odell, a man in Virginia, who was killed by the state of Virginia. I believe he was innocent. When you read the case, you see for yourself. But Italy got involved in his case. The Pope got involved in his case. Mother Teresa got involved in his case on the phone with Governor George Allen. Y'all think Mother Teresa is real calm like that and a little holy lady, right? Should have heard her with Governor George Allen. He was holding the phone like this going, but mother, but mother. And she's letting him have it. Like, you're going to kill this man. Don't you kill this man. Well, at any rate. And so, I was the spiritual advisor to Joseph Odell. And so, through that, I got to have a dialogue directly with Pope John Paul. All of Italy. They buried Joseph Odell in Palermo. The mayor of Palermo visited him on death row and said, Joseph, if they kill you, we will not let you be buried in the soil of Virginia. We will ship your body over to Palermo, and we will bury you in a very special cemetery there. And in fact, that's what happened. And in the course of things, I got to have this dialogue with Pope John Paul. And I said, Your Holiness, does the Catholic Church only uphold the dignity of innocent life? Which, of course, we should do. But what about guilty life? And when I'm walking with a man to execution, as happened with Patrick Saunier, when I was there in the death house with him, and finally they summoned him, and he's chained hand and foot, surrounded by guards, and he says to me, Sister, just pray God holds up my legs as I make this walk. And I said to the Pope, where is the dignity in this death? A man has been rendered defenseless, and he's taken out and killed. And what the Pope changed was the criterion the church had used for 1,600 years. He cut out the words in the catechism for a grave, a grievous crime. And in his own encyclical, he said, because we have a way to defend society. So therefore, no matter how grave or grievous the crime, if we have a way to keep society safe, we don't need to kill anymore. It means we get to save our guards from having to do the killing for us. We get to save our prosecutors from having to get involved in these cases where they're going to seek death. It means we get to save our jurors, who are just people just like us, who are asked to take the responsibility in their hands to decide on the death of their fellow human being. And where maybe God wants to put a comma, we want to put a period and say, that's the end of your life, and we're sending you into eternity. Who are we to think that we could ever do that? I want to invite you to think. I want to invite you to reflect. The death penalty is not a peripheral moral issue about what to do with a few dangerous criminals and whether or not we ought to have the death penalty for them. It hits the core and the soul of who we are as a society, and every one of our wounds is in this thing. Our racism is in it. We only select the poor, and that's in it, and then a penchant in us to think that we can solve social problems with violence, that violence can be redemptive. Sometimes violence is the only way. And you think about the murder victim's family. You think about if it was you and if it was your loved one who was killed, and now you're going to go to that trial, and now you're going to hear, oh, yay, victory. We come out of the courtroom with our fingers and a victory sign. We got the death penalty. And you begin to wait. And you wait 10 years, 15 years. Do you really believe that you could be summoned and you could sit on the front row and then watch as another human being is killed and that can heal the human heart? What does that say about us as a society? Does it really? And that's what was behind those murder victims' families that stood before the New Jersey legislature and said, don't kill for us. I want to invite you to reflect. I want to invite you to read. The books that we have, I've signed them all. And so if you want to just get a signed book, then it'll expedite things. If you want me to write your name in it, I will. You can get both Dead Man Walking and Death of Innocence for $25. Every dollar of that goes to help the ministry against the death penalty to awaken the American people. Every bit of it. We have those books signed by Susan and me for $100. if obviously a fundraiser, if any of you have a rich aunt or somebody, and you whatever, we'll be happy to have that. And I want to invite you to consider that little white piece of paper you were given. If you have never put your precious signature where you have signed on to be part of a movement that is going to abolish state killing, I invite you to do that. Those of you who are Catholics, there's a special little box for you to mark, because the bishops are working in a Catholic campaign to end the death penalty, and I invite you to join us. So thank you for your attention. It's 8:25.
Want to answer a few questions?
No, I think we better let it go because it's 8:25. Or what do you think? What do you want to do?
How about three or four questions?
Okay.
Let me say that.
I can say it. I can do it now. You have just a few minutes, just so it's not just my voice in here tonight. If anybody has a question or comment, we'll have a little conversation, not long, and then I'll go over to those books because I'm anxious to sign them for you. Any question or any comment? Yes.
You do a lot of work with the Innocence Project in New York?
You do?
No, do you do a lot of work with the Innocence Project in New York?
I know that when there are Innocence Projects, maybe David Kaczynski knows about it, but what's your question?
Have you worked with them a lot? With the
no,
Innocence Project.
Not New York.
Oh.
Y'all know about Innocence Projects. It's done by professors and students who take people's cases and try to show their innocence. Okay, a couple other people. Over here, could we have the mic over here?
I'm sure this is not new to you, but how do you handle an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth?
An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Did you know that when that was written in the scripture, it was to try to prevent one village killing another whole village, where something would happen to somebody, they'd go in and kill everybody, and it was to limit the violence. Now, they don't have prisons, right? So only an eye for an eye, only a life for life, only a tooth for a tooth and a limb for a limb. Because they're beginning to limit, to hold back on vengeance. And you trace that through the scriptures so that when you come to Jesus, you come to Jesus. When if we take Jesus seriously, what did he say? You've heard it said an eye for an eye, but I say to you. And it's because love is the whole message. And Lloyd LeBlanc got it. Because the love in him would be compromised if he began to hate. It would change him. And that's what Jesus meant. Love your enemies. Pray for those who persecute you, because the love in you is greater than the hatred in them. And that is the way that we have to end. Now, it doesn't mean we don't need to protect ourselves from people who are dangerous. It's just we don't need to kill them anymore. So an eye for an eye doesn't apply to us in the United States of America, as it no longer applies to 90% of the countries in the world that have done away with the death penalty, because we have a way to keep ourselves safe. Anybody? Yes, here, and then there's one there.
What are your thoughts on the Troy Davis case?
Troy Davis. Does everybody know about Troy Davis? You can Google him up when you get home. You know about Troy Davis. A Georgia case, when he was brought to trial, there were how many? 9? Eyewitnesses pointed to Troy Davis and said he killed this person. Well, he, of course, did not have good defense. He's a poor black kid, and he didn't have a chance. They found him guilty. They sentenced him to death. Now, with the lawyers working, they are able, 7 of those 9 people at least have recanted, and they said the police forced them to say that, and they were scared. They've recanted and said it wasn't the truth. And now we're in the struggle with the courts, the appeals court, saying, too late, procedural bars, you should have said all this sooner. And he goes, but I didn't have a good attorney sooner. And that happens all the time. So his life is on the line now. And finally, it would come up to the governor that would have to commute his sentence. And few governors are willing to do that. They say the courts are the ones that do justice. I'm just the governor. I'm not going to commute a sentence and second-guess the courts. So his life is really in danger now at this time. And so what are we urging people to do? To write to the governor, the Board of Pardons. This is what a Board of Pardons is supposed to be. They can really give clemency. They don't have to go by what the courts say. They could say, but look at the situation here. They didn't know this. And Google him up and write. Do something for him. Are they going to kill this kid? They are going to kill this kid. And the court system is going to kill this kid. And in the end of Death of Innocence, I say it is the courts who killed Dobie Williams, the first man that I was with who had an IQ of 65. And it was the courts that killed Joseph O'Dell because they wouldn't allow him to have hearings because they said their timeline was over. It's pure legalism, pure procedure. And when you're dealing with poor people who can't get good defense at trial, and then the burden is on you to try to show this, and then you have these bars you have to jump through in timelines, and so people get killed because of procedures. So I ask you to get involved in that case, and it's urgent that you do it now because Troy Davis is, it's very urgent for his life. His sister has been working so hard to try to save her brother. She goes to meetings. She talks to people. She says, will you write for my brother? And it would take a massive outpouring. So I ask you to Troy Davis in Georgia. Thank you for bringing that up. Okay, one other person. Here's somebody. There you go.
The Catholic cardinal in Scotland, Keith O'Brien, last month said that the U.S. Suffers from a culture of vengeance. And he said that he was glad to live in a country where justice is tempered by mercy. I was wondering, would you agree with him that we do have a culture of vengeance here? And if so, what do you see as the roots of it?
You know what I think? Do we have a culture of vengeance here in the people? Let me tell you what I think. Because I get this question a lot when I'm in Europe. I get it a lot when I'm in England. What is it about the American people that you're so wedded to vengeance? Now, this is over 20 years of talking to the American people, meeting people just like you. I'm convinced it's not that the people are wedded to vengeance. We're so far removed from the death penalty and seeing it that we're non-reflective. It's that we don't think about it deeply. And that's what we need for a moral conscience on something. You have to bring people close to it. So in Dead Man Walking and in the film, to bring you close and say, here's what it means to kill a human being. Here's what it means for the guards. Here's what it means. And I have found overwhelmingly that the American public are reflective and that most people go, well, I didn't know it was like that. Or no, I'm not for that. But they've been given a chance to reflect on it. And the way the film, Dead Man Walking, is done, it's done so that it just brings you over to both sides, helps you get in touch with the ambivalence that we feel, and then to say, is this our only option? Is this what we have to do? And that's not who we are. And, you know, in all the deepest ways in which we have changed in this country and grown morally, we start off with a position like, yeah, it's okay to have black people as property. Sure, you can have them as property. Slavery's fine. And we grow past it. I do believe that we are on the road now to grow past the death penalty as well. And so I ask you not only to think, but when you come to a moral position, then to act. If you don't act and it continues, then we are all complicit in it because we're not acting to change it. Once we become conscious, a great responsibility comes with being conscious. Father Sossima in the Brothers Karamazov, Dostoevsky's great novel, said, everyone is personally responsible, but no one is more responsible than I am. And when we come to awareness, now I appreciate that maybe you're not there yet, and that's why I urge you to read and to reflect and to think. But then when you know where you are, to act for justice, and it's going to liberate you. Because we often feel so powerless. We feel so paralyzed. I'm one little person. What can I do? One little person can stand up. One little person can act. One little person can write a letter for Troy Davis because it's in the act of justice for someone who has nobody to be on his side. That's what we can do. And when we act, I found when I began to act, it was like a big burden lifted. All those years, I didn't know what to do. I felt bad about things, but I never acted. I'm liberated now in a way. I get tired because you work hard, but it's okay because we're moving toward that day. Do we believe that about our people, that we could be a people who live without violence? We must help that day to come. And I invite you to give your energy and your life in some way to help that to happen. Thank you.